the navigator of the ship.
Sort of.
Continue.
Sorry. I was trying to figure out how to get into that.
Well, you're in it now.
Yep.
Sit back, it's time to get groovy. Question, do you remember that movie?
Welcome back to Remember That Movie. I am the third Alejandro Rosa on IMDb.
And I'm Steve Johnston, and I am not on IMDb.
Welcome back to our podcast where we look at the films of the past with the eyes of today. In this episode, Steve is going to take us on a journey. What are we talking about today, Steve?
Today we are talking about the 1986 family sci-fi movie Flight of the Navigator. This one was a staple of my childhood. Did not see it when it originally came out in 1986, was too young at the time, but caught it once it started making the rounds on TV, and I do remember renting it quite a few times from the local video store. Now, I am excited for a couple of reasons. First, because I enjoyed this one when I was younger. But secondly, I think you did too. This is one of those movies where we actually both watched it when we were younger.
That's right. So our last episode was The Beastmaster, a film that I said I grew up watching. This is in the same category as that. This film was on all the time when I was really, really little, and I watched it constantly. However, I have not watched this film, like The Beastmaster, since I was very, very small. And I had forgotten a great deal of it.
I experienced the same thing for 3 seconds. I will explain once we get there. Released in 1986, based on a story by Mark H. Baker, it was directed by Randall Kleiser. He directed Grease in 1978, Blue Lagoon in 1980, and then was tapped to direct Flight of the Navigator. The film, although you can find it on Disney Plus, and it bears the, brought to you by Disney, was not produced by Disney originally. It was produced by PSO, Producer Sales Organization, in conjunction with Viking Film. So PSO was a company that started in the 70s, and its main thing was distributing films to foreign markets that were independently made in the US. That was their thing. Then in 1984, they decided, no, we actually want to get into the production side of it. We want to make things ourselves. And this happened to be one of the films that they had a hand in actually making. They put up, I think it's estimated, about 2/3 of the budget, the remaining third coming from Viking Film, a Norwegian production company. And because they were a Norwegian production company, they had a clause, a stipulation, if you will, that part of the movie had to be shot in Norway. We'll get to that a little later on, but that's kind of where we are coming from. So with that, I would like to regale you with a synopsis, if I may, and then we will get into the film itself. All right, the movie in a nutshell. July 4th, 1978, 12-year-old David Freeman is sent to bring his 8-year-old brother home when he falls into a ravine in a forest. Picking himself up, he discovers that his home is occupied by strangers. Confused, it's revealed that it is now 1986. What was an instant for him has been 8 years for the rest of the world. His family is approached by NASA scientist Dr. Faraday, who offers to help them find answers to what has happened. Dr. Faraday is not being entirely truthful, however, as he believes there is a connection between David and a crashed UFO they have at their research facility. And it turns out, he's right. The spaceship is the one that abducted David 8 years prior, and now needs his help to return home. Joining forces, David and the ship escape the NASA facility, try to reunite David with his family, but realizing that NASA will never leave him alone, David asks the spaceship to return him to 1978, despite the inherent danger in doing so.
Well done.
Thank you.
So, Steve,
sir,
who is in this movie?
Starring as David Freeman, we have Joey Kramer, a Canadian actor who auditioned for the role, the producers were looking for someone natural. They didn't want an quote-unquote overly trained child star. They wanted someone who would just kind of come in, be natural, have a sense of wonder about them, and Joey fit the bill nicely. On top of that, clinching the deal, he could cry on cue. And as soon as the director saw that, Joey was in.
He's wonderful.
He is. So far as child actors go, I think one of the best that we have talked about on this particular podcast. We have the rest of the Freeman family. There is his brother, played when he is 8 years old by Albie Whittaker. This was Albie's only film role. Matt Adler took on the role of Jeff when he was 16. You might remember Matt from the movie Teen Wolf. His dad, Bill, was played by Cliff DeYoung, and his mother by Veronica Cartwright, whose face both my wife and I recognized, but we couldn't quite place.
I was the same way with the dad. Both of them are actors that I've seen in films before. Yeah. I didn't know their names. I just said, oh, I've seen you in things.
Lauren actually looked her up and said, oh, she has been in an episode of practically every TV show that she used to watch. I recognized her, having looked through her filmography later, that she is in Alien and The Right Stuff.
The scene, the main scene, and the rest in the, when they're eating, and the alien comes out, she's there.
Yep.
She's in that scene.
Playing the NASA scientist Dr. Faraday, we have Howard Hessman, an actor who has been in a great many movies and TV shows. The only one I really recognized him from was the TV show WKRP in Cincinnati, because he was DJ Johnny Fever. Exactly. Yes.
I want you to know, I did not know WKRP in Cincinnati until I got together with my wife, and she introduced me to Johnny Fever and the rest of the cast.
And then the last name that it would be remiss of me to skip is the voice of the spaceship, whom is named Max for short, voiced by Paul Mall. At least that's how he's credited. It's actually Paul Rubens of Pee-wee Herman fame provides Max's voice.
Thank you so much, because he does the laugh.
Yes.
And the Pee-wee Herman laugh. And I was like, oh my God, I know that laugh. I know that voice. Where do I know that from? And I was thinking, it's like, is it Howie Mandel? No, that's not it. It's not Robin Williams. It's not Howie Mandel. I know who this is. And I could not figure it out. I went to bed last night, like, tossing and turning. Like, what is that laugh? I know that laugh. Well done, Paul Rubens. Well done.
He asked to be credited under a pseudonym because he did not want his name sort of attached to the film in a way that would draw attention to him. He wanted it to kind of be, oh, there's a surprise for those who go and see it, that, oh yes, that voice does sound familiar, as you said, because the laugh, the delivery of some of the lines, it's like, ah, yeah, we know who that is. So that is our main cast, I believe. Was there anyone else that you wanted me to call attention to? And I'm hoping the answer is no, because those are all the names I have written down.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You have made one.
Oh, I have made one glaring
mistake.
Wow.
Glaringly obvious. In fact, one of the first people credited, you missed.
Yes, you're absolutely right. But I feel that it is somewhat fitting that I accidentally skipped over her. This is, I think, her fifth film, a 21-year-old Sarah Jessica Parker, playing Carolyn McAdams, an intern at the NASA facility. Now, my comments a moment ago about her deserving to kind of be forgotten off of my list come from her opinion of this film. When asked about the experience in an interview not too long back, she just kind of looked at the interview and said, it was just a job. I auditioned, I got a part, I got paid. Quote, I can't even tell you what it was about or who I played.
To be fair, she was 21 years old. She has like 3, maybe 4 scenes?
Yes.
She was probably, if anything, like she probably filmed it in a day and then she was gone.
Yep.
You know, like, yeah. I think, who was it? I've heard of this from other actors who they don't remember being in films. We remember them being in films.
Right.
But especially when the part is really small or earlier in their career, a lot of them just forget because it was just one of however many jobs. It just happens that you have latched onto it in a way that they never did. I find that amusing.
The funny thing is that Joey Kramer remembers her very vividly and really enjoyed the time that they spent working together on the scenes that they did. It's just kind of striking that, oh, you know, he really liked working with her, and she's like, I don't even remember being there.
I met this kid, we said a few lines, I went home.
Was it.
The end.
The end. I think I'm going to return to a comment that I made earlier that I experienced what you experienced, where for 3 seconds, I did not remember this movie at all, because we open with a city skyline and this strange silver rectangle moving across it. And I got very confused. And then the memory banks kicked in and I realized, oh, a dog's about to jump into frame because that's a frisbee. And then we are introduced to a lot of good boys and good girls.
There are a series of UFO fakeouts at the beginning of the film. They do it multiple times. They make it look like something's going to be a UFO.
Yep.
First it's the frisbee, then it's the blimp.
The blimp.
Right? There's a shadow. Everyone looks up, and you know it's a UFO movie, so everyone's looking, and you look up, and you're like, oh, are they going to show? No, it's a blimp.
It's a blimp.
And then when David is in the woods, and he's walking, he looks up, and you're like, oh, here it is, and it's a water tower. So it's a total series of fake-outs, which did make me laugh.
We're introduced to David and his family here, and one of the things that reviewers liked and that I liked too is that they just appear to be a normal, everyday family. I loved that we had the old station wagon with the kids in the back where the seat faced backwards and then the rest of the trunk was open, and so the kids are just climbing around each other while driving down the street. That brought back memories.
I will say this film definitely started hitting the nostalgia buttons for me.
Was it the socks?
Okay.
The knee-high socks pulled all the way up so that you could see the stripes?
No, it was the Barklers and the slip and slide.
Oh, wow, yes, okay.
And I was like, oh, wow, yes, I think I have a scar on my knee still from a bad slip and slide episode.
Yeah, now that you've brought it up, I remember there was a kid in the neighborhood that I grew up with. Their family had a slip and slide. He got a nasty scrape down some part of his body that scarred over, and because of that, I was never allowed to go on slip and slides when I was younger.
We put an outdoor chair cushion that had, like, you know, the buttons, like the plastic buttons on it. We put it underneath the slip and slide with the hopes that we would slide and then fly.
Oh.
And I did that, and one of those buttons went into my knee.
Ooh.
And I went home terrified that I was going to have to get stitches. And my mom just laughed and said, you don't need stitches. I don't know, Mom. I sort of thought I did, but all right. I still have the scar. So yes, but the slip and slides, the sprinklers, it was neat. It was just neat. I enjoyed that very much. But thankfully, don't worry, folks. If you think this is going to be a feel-good movie, there's a lot of trauma coming.
Oh, heck yes.
Because as you said earlier, at some point, brother goes off, and then they're like, David, go get your brother, right? And he's like, oh, it's just half a mile. He's 8, right? Which is funny, because that's totally normal.
Yeah, in 1978, even early 1980s, that was perfectly acceptable. We'll send the 12-year-old on his own through the dark forest to collect his 8-year-old brother from the neighbors.
You know, he has the fall, he wakes up, he goes home, there are different people at the house, and he bursts into tears in the most natural kid way.
Yes.
Ripping my heart out because he's looking at these strangers and all he says is, where's my mom? And I almost burst into tears with him. It's like, oh my God, this poor child. And so that's how it begins. And then, you know, they take him to the police, of course. And by the way, the people in this house are nothing but kind to him.
Yes.
You know, they're like, you know, let's help you. Let's call the police and all that.
I do love how this kind of highlights how not jaded, not cynical I've become now that I'm older. But if a 12-year-old boy suddenly burst into my study, I'm not sure I would just calmly stand up and say, "Can I help you, son?"
And then the police do their research and find that he is missing. And he's been missing for 8 years. And then they go to the parents' new house.
Yes.
And this is where I call, oh, here comes family trauma, because you realize, oh my God, for 8 years, this child just vanished. So they've been living with that. And later when you hear that the brother said, you know, they made me put up posters like every weekend.
Every Saturday, yeah.
Every Saturday I had to put up posters everywhere. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is way darker than I remembered it. Jeez. And so, yes, big family trauma when, of course, they come out and he's scared because they don't look like themselves. They look older.
Yep.
And they are just, oh my God, my child, my child. And, I, you know, I'm not going to lie. Like, I'm a parent. You're a parent. Like, that was messed up. I was just like, oh my, like, just even the thought of whatever that feels like.
Yeah.
Messed me up. And I was like, damn you, Disney UFO movie. You're not supposed to go this deep. I do have one note.
Hmm.
I remembered the music. The music for this film, there's clearly a tune that they used for the spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
And when that started playing, there was like something in the back of my brain lit up where all the little tiny childhood memories are. One of those light bulbs lit up for the first time. We know what this is. We've heard this many times before.
The composer for this film was Alan Silvestri. Alan Silvestri is to Robert Zemeckis what John Williams is to Steven Spielberg. Like, if there was a Robert Zemeckis film, Alan Silvestri was involved. So he did the soundtrack for Back to the Future, Forrest Gump, Castaway, non-Zemeckis films under his belt, The Abyss, and then Captain America, The Avengers, Infinity War, Endgame.
Oh,
huge
wow.
List of titles. This soundtrack was a departure from his norm because there is no orchestra in this particular movie. Everything was done by him on an early synthesizer. This was all electronic music for the entire film.
It was really cool. I did enjoy that at some point when he went to NASA, they had decorated his room and they put Transformers, G.I. Joes,
yeah.
a toy Porsche. It was very, very 80s.
Absolutely.
And then at some point he told him he could use the remote control wand. I loved that so much. I was like, wow, that's old. Even I've never heard it called that. I forever loved the design of the spaceship. It is silver.
Yes.
It is just silver. And it fascinated me back then. It fascinated me now. Clearly, it looks a little dated, but some of it doesn't look dated at all. Some of it looks still pretty cool. This beautiful hovering thing. It's just really cool. I've forgotten that the connection between David and the spaceship and why he was connected to the spaceship. Didn't remember any of that either.
Okay.
I just knew that at some point he went into the spaceship. And I knew that there was a kind of robotic thing.
Yes.
With an eye.
The eye.
That would move around and talk. Like I said, it's been a while, folks. It's been a while.
This was a brand new design at the time. The director wanted something that had not been seen before. The overall shape of the ship was designed by Edward Eyth. This was one of his earliest works. He has since gone on to do sort of strange and futuristic designs for many other movies. The director wanted it to be silver. He thought that that would be absolutely amazing. And he was actually warned against going with a silver spaceship by his old college roommate, a gentleman by the name of George Lucas, who pointed out that if you go with a silver spaceship, everything is going to get reflected and it's going to be an absolute nightmare.
He's not wrong. He's not wrong. That's true.
But he went ahead anyway, and I'm kind of glad he did, because it is an absolutely amazing looking device. The ship, they made two physical models, one which the actors could actually climb up into via the stairs in the opening. A second one that would be connected to a crane so that it could be lifted into and out of shot so that it looked like it was flying. But the rest of it was all very early CGI. Randall Kleiser knew a guy who worked in computer-generated images, In fact, he knew the guy that worked on Tron, because it was his brother Jeff. Jeff had done some work not only on Tron, but also on some commercials, and then on some sort of testing out new things. So they had done a commercial for Tide in which a Tide bottle shifted shape into the shape of the United States, I believe. And he liked the look of that. And so that became the door, how the door just kind of melts and then forms a set of stairs. The other thing was the reflective surfaces. Jeff Kleiserhood was working on and developed the computer system whereby they would take the background shot from the film, put it into the computer, put the shot of the ship in whichever orientation it was facing on top of that. The computer would then crunch the numbers and figure out what would be reflected on the surface of the ship. And then that got recorded onto the film for the final, you know, the final production piece. They were limited by the computer power of the time. They used a supercomputer called the Foonly F1, which had a whopping great 18 megabytes of memory.
Unbelievable.
The process involved and the limited memory meant that they had to render one frame at a time. They would put in a frame from the movie, the ship and its orientation, the computer would render what would reflect upon it, and then that image would get sent to a second computer to actually get transferred onto the film. The memory would then be cleared, and then the next frame would come in, and it would do the entire process over again. It was fascinating kind of reading about that, because that sort of reflective special effects, we could probably do on our phones with the right app these days.
Absolutely, yes.
Back then, they were dealing with a computer that would crash 5 to 6 times a day because it was having trouble rendering what was going on. You can tell that it's a little dated.
Sure.
But it still looks awesome.
Yeah, it absolutely does. There are things that look way worse than this. I don't know. I think it is because of what they did with the silver that it makes it just a little timeless. And the effects were so advanced that even though now they're not top of the line, they still looked pretty
they
good.
Still most, look
most
good.
Of it. Yeah. And then we have the inside of the ship.
The inside of the ship.
Also silver.
Yes. Done up entirely in aluminum, if I am to believe what I read.
That's what it looked like.
This is where we get to Norway. So you remember how one of the production companies said, well, we've got money for you, but you have to do some shooting in Norway. The director thought about it and figured, well, there's really only one type of scene that would lend itself well to Norway. So they shot the majority of the movie in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and the surrounding areas. And then in February, they packed up the ship, they packed up the crew, they packed up the cast, and flew them to Oslo. Drove about an hour south. If what I have read is correct, they set up shop in a biscuit factory warehouse and shot the interior scenes for the spaceship. Very futuristic looking. I liked it.
And then we have Max.
Max, who, as you describe, is kind of this metallic eye on a arm that can run around the interior of the ship.
And speaks and knows however many languages, etc.
Yep. When he first starts speaking, he is very sort of low and almost monotonous, very computer-like, I suppose. When we were younger, once we had watched this movie, we would run around for the next couple of days yelling, "Compliance!"
Which is something that the character of Max does.
A lot.
Because he has assigned David to be the navigator of the ship.
Sort of.
Continue.
Sorry. I was trying to figure out how to get into that.
Well, you're in it now.
Yep.
Percy said I was wrong, and now he's going to correct it.
No, I didn't say you were wrong. It's just not quite that straightforward. So Max, the spaceship, was the one who abducted David. As one of the tests that they did on David, they filled his brain to capacity, playing on the old trope that, oh, humans only use 10% of their brain. So they filled his head with, like, star charts and navigational information. So David's head is filled with navigational information. Having dropped David back in the forest, Max then ran into some power lines, and the resulting charge erased his databanks of the navigational information. So he is seeking out David to essentially scan his brain, get the information back, so that he can complete his mission. The problem that Max had with David is that their tests revealed that the human body might not survive the journey back in time, because ordinarily they collect a specimen, take them away, do some tests, go back in time to drop them at the exact point they were collected so that no one is any the wiser. They couldn't do that with David, which is why they've dropped him back 8 years after he disappeared.
Now, I was going to add that part of that, which they seem to kind of allude to, is just the travel time between the distant planet that they are from and Earth.
Yes.
That's the 8 years. That's the journey going there and then coming back. That's what they made it sound like.
It gets into traveling faster than the speed of light and time dilation. Because the journey, according to the screen that's displayed, only takes 2.2 hours. So for David, 4 hours have passed. But because they were traveling far faster than the speed of light, that's why the rest of the universe has experienced 8 years during that same time. I am sorry. I am being so pedantic about this.
And at the same time, you just explained what I said just in greater detail.
Yeah.
I'm trying to summarize, folks. Steve
no,
does not want a summary.
We want details.
Exact, precise details,
the
folks.
Writers took the time to put the details into the movie. The people deserve to know. David goes into the hangar, finds the ship, the door opens, he goes inside, meets Max for the first time. And then NASA realizes that, oh, the ship that we've been trying to break into for the past however many days is now open. And so the scientists and armed guards rushed in. Very poor trigger discipline on the part of the guards, I might say. Every single one of them had their fingers on the trigger. I digress. Max says, we're not safe here. We need to leave. Should I get us out of this building? David says yes. And then starts my favorite series of events, because the door closes, the ship powers up, breaks the chains that are holding it down, knocks over all the lights and other accoutrement that have been set up around it, remotely opens the door, and then flies out and just hovers over the airfield while everyone is kind of cowering underneath it, looking at it, going, oh, look at what's happening. Max then asks, all right, what should we do now? David says, I need to think. Just take us 20 miles away. At which point, the ship shoots straight up into the sky.
Scaring the absolute heck out of David.
David is plastered to the floor. At 20 miles an hour, the ship stops, which launches him into the ceiling. He floats back down, says, what the heck was that? So you said take us 20 miles away. I meant 20 miles along the ground. So the ship then drops the 20 miles, landing exactly 6 feet above the ground like it was before, causing everyone standing on the ground to go, ah! And duck. It then changes shape to its sort of speed form, flies off with a boom, and blows the roof off of a guard shack as it flies over it. I was laughing hysterically at several bits because I was just enjoying it so much.
Oh, and you know what? The good news is that at least we have the ability to have 80s music at several times during this delightful movie.
Yes.
Including, and then we don't get 80s music, but we get a lovely Beach Boys song for a whole scene. When I think, is it around the time where David learns to fly the UFO?
Yes, when David learns to fly the UFO, he says, put on some music. Max scans a couple of radio stations and they land on a Beach Boys song. So he's singing, is it California Girls as he's flying the ship?
Is it Round, Round, I get around? Is that right?
Oh, no, it might be, yes.
I forget what that one's called.
A Beach Boys song.
Yeah. This is why we are a movie podcast and not a music podcast. They get to explain the whole brain scan. Again, I need to download all the files off of your USB. Gets everything out. But unfortunately, he gets everything out, which includes the mind of a 12-year-old boy. And so from that moment on, Max is a 12-year-old. Talks like a 12-year-old, argues like a 12-year-old. Is an absolutely weird, hysterical thing that it does. And that's when we really see the Paul Rubens come out.
Yes.
know, the supercomputer is acting like a child. To the point that at one point it does. It shuts down and says, oh, you think you can fly the ship? Okay, do it. And it just shuts down as the thing is falling.
Yep.
And then David is desperately trying to figure out what button he's supposed to press to make it stop falling.
He's pushing every silver button on this silver background ship that he can find.
So at some point, David realizes, I want to go home.
Yes.
When Max tells him, I can't send you back to your time, he says, well, then let me just go home. Take me back to my parents. And so begins the journey of them essentially going like cross country.
This was the part that I just kind of blindly accepted when I was younger. Now I'm raising an eyebrow over it, because from what we have seen, they stay in the vicinity of Florida up to and including the brain scan, because Max drops them into the ocean. I'm not sure if it was East Coast or West Coast, but very nice coral reef they kind of sit on. They do the brain scan, and then they take off again. And then somehow they end up over Tokyo. Didn't quite follow that. I kind of think it was supposed to be that David was flying and therefore they got lost, but I'm not entirely sure. Say they make their way back from Tokyo across the Pacific, across the United States, stopping briefly at Al's Gator Farm.
Yeah, I think that's probably where the script falls apart a little bit, because we've already pointed out that the spaceship can go insanely fast.
Mm-hmm.
It can travel from one point of the globe to the other in a heartbeat. But it takes us half a movie to go from one side of the country to the other.
Yes.
And so I was like, okay, that doesn't make any sense. But fine. And yes, they stop at Big Al's Gator Farm, which did provide a hilarious moment, because they have it's a gas station as well as everything else. And the spaceship just pulls into the gas station.
Yes.
Like nothing.
I'm sorry. I thought you were going to talk about the bit that happened in between that, because the spaceship comes down into frame. The door morphs into the stairs, and the last stair forms just hitting the pressure line that rings the bell for the attendant of the gas station.
That's true.
Sorry. I love that bit.
Yeah. And then he just walks up to Al and asks for change, so that he can make a call, because we are in payphone land, and that's how we made calls. That is how we did it. And he turns around and stares at the spaceship, says nothing, is just in complete awe, reaches into his pocket, gives David some coins to make a call, and then just stands there for the rest of the scene. At one point, a family shows up, and they're talking, and they're trying to talk to him, and he's just staring. He goes, I don't know about your Native American stuff here, but your spaceship looks really cool. And again, Big Al says nothing. He is still staring at this thing. And the kids almost get into the ship. And Dad's like, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Come on, we got to go. When the spaceship finally departs, Big Al speaks for the very first time, turns to the dad, and says, he just said he wanted to phone home. That was great. David and Max are trying to figure out where his parents' house is. They can't identify it. And David eventually calls and talks to his brother and says, you know, I need your help. You need to give me a signal that we can see. And that's when Jeff remembers the fireworks box in David's stuff, which we see at the beginning of the movie. Chekhov's fireworks.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Very good.
If you listen to our last episode, you'll know that I learned a thing. And so he climbs up to the roof of the house and sets off fireworks so that David and Max can see where they are. And that felt very 1980s to me. NASA figures out he's going home. He realizes, like, I can't. They're going to take me away. And he's right, right? And we, the audience, are like, yeah, David, you can't get out of that ship, man. They're going to take you away and put you in a locked room again. And then we have what I refer to as family trauma part two.
Two. Mm-hmm.
Because they're desperate for their child. They only allowed him to go to NASA for a couple of days, and then they wanted him back. So they're just desperate to have their kid back, which they haven't had in 8 years. These poor parents, I'm sorry, my heart was breaking during this scene. Because he's standing there, there's NASA people everywhere, everyone's trying to tell everybody to get back, right? While the mom and dad are just desperately trying to get to David.
Mm-hmm.
And David just looks at them and goes, I'm sorry. I don't belong here now. I love you. And then he leaves. And I was like broken inside.
Oh.
Like something shattered in my heart.
Oh.
And I was like, what? No. Oh my God, these poor people. But the good news is, folks, we do go back in time. And then David wakes up and it's the past again. And no time has passed. And the parents are not traumatized and his little brother is not traumatized. And David's fine.
He runs up to them and declares his love for each and every one of them. Jeff asks, are you mad at me? And he's like, no, I love you too. To which the mom and the dad just kind of look at each other like, wait, what? What? Okay.
It was very surreal to me to watch this film. It was really cool to not just see the nostalgia, but feel the nostalgia. Because it kept making me remember being a kid, a little tiny kid. I mean, David was my age or younger when I watched this. On this podcast, we review movies, right? We talk about the films from different times. And we try to make allowances when we can, but we also, you know, are critical. But there is something to be said about some of these movies and the way that it hits that nostalgia button. And this one did it for me so much. Because again, it just reminded me of what being a little kid was like.
I liked movies like this where the protagonist was, quote unquote, my age at the time that I first saw them. Because there was an extra layer of imagination that kind of got triggered when that would be the case. Because there was this sense of, oh, this could happen to me. That could be me. That sort of feeling that, oh, I could go on these grand adventures. This movie was not only a joy to watch, I enjoyed it thoroughly now that I am older, but also triggered that nostalgia switch where it's like, oh, do you remember how much you loved this when you were younger and how it made you feel then? It was good. At the end of the movie, I have to say there was one thing that bugged me, one thing that I wish they had done slightly differently, one little addition that I wish they had made. And that's Chekhov's crush. At the beginning of the film, it is established that David has a crush on one of the girls in the neighborhood. She drives by on her bike. He looks at her kind of wistfully. He then spies on her from his room using a telescope. Dad walks in, says, well, have you talked to her? Have you said anything to her? And David's like, no. A very similar conversation is had in 1986 with Carolyn, who says, have you said anything to her? And he kind of goes, no. Part of me wishes that as part of the ending wrap-up, he had at least said hi to the girl and had the girl say hi back and smile. Just like, oh, I've got some more confidence having been through this really amazing adventure, and therefore I'm going to act on my feelings. But that's really my only complaint.
You know what? I bet that was cut, because you're right. They do set that up. They do bring it up twice.
Yep.
So my guess is that there was a scene, whether they filmed it, whether it was in the original script, that he did have that. I bet you anything. And then they realized like no time or it wasn't as effective.
Yeah.
So I can assume that the editor was like, we need to cut this. Nobody's going to care.
Except a couple of guys 40 years down the road, but
yeah,
that's their problem, not ours.
How did this movie do?
The movie did okay. The reviews were mostly positive. I couldn't find a nice choice quote like, you know, we've had from Gene Siskel in the past. All of them said, yeah, this is a good family movie. This is fun and enjoyable. Oh, the spaceship's rather impressive, that sort of thing. It only made $18.5 million at the box office against its $9 million budget, so it covered expenses, but was not a huge success. Part of that was due to what it released against, I think. Because coming out the same day as it did was Howard the Duck, which, admittedly, it did better than Howard the Duck. It came out against Friday the 13th, Part 6, which... Yeah, it didn't do anywhere near as well as that. And none of those movies could compete against another movie that was out. It had released a few weeks prior, but was still doing very well at the box office, and that was Aliens.
Aliens?
Aliens. So, not a fantastic performance, but an okay one. And since then, like a lot of movies that we have spoken about, it's kind of gained a quote-unquote cult following. There are diehard fans who really like this movie. And with it being on TV and now available, you know, on demand via Disney Plus, people are still very much enjoying it. Since the early 2000s, there have been talk of a remake. There was a documentary called Life After the Navigator, which tells Joey Kramer's story, because following this movie, he had a couple of smaller roles, and then he got out of the entertainment business and went and just tried to be a regular kid, which did not work. He got into drugs, started getting arrested for a few various crimes. The big one occurring, I think, in 2016, when he was arrested for his part in an attempted bank robbery in British Columbia. He spent some time in jail, but has since turned his life around and is interested in getting back into acting.
Well, I don't know about you, but I can definitely say that this has been a wild trip down memory lane for a film that was not bad, as opposed to the last one we did, which I felt was bad. This is not a bad film. It's not perfect by any means, but it's not a bad film.
No, it's...
It's interesting. It's sort of original. It's darker than you expect it to be, and then goofy again, and then dark and goofy. It kind of plays both sides. Yeah, I liked it.
So with that, I'm going to pass the baton back to you, sir. Have you picked our next movie?
We have been doing several in the 1980s, so I decided, instead of going backwards in time, I'd push us forwards in time for a film that I will be very curious about your personal history with it, and that is 1999's Wild Wild West.
Excellent.
Thank you so much for spending this time with us, whether you were listening on any of the many platforms, whether it was iTunes or you're with us on YouTube, wherever, Spotify. Thank you so much. You help us continue to do these, and we hope that you enjoy them as much as we do.
If you did, do please leave a comment or click the like button. Or if you're feeling like super generous, subscribe.
If you have any ideas for movies that you'd like us to do, please leave us a note in the comments and let us know. We have chosen movies before based on feedback. So if we're missing something and you really want us to cover it, let us know. So thanks again, and we'll see you at the next episode.
Compliance.
Sit back, it's time to get groovy. Question, do you remember that movie?